Coming up on Boston Public Radio, oral argument today on California's Prop 8, tomorrow on the Defense of Marriage Act. We'll hear from both sides, their arguments and predictions. Then I will make a prediction that when Wegmans Supermarket comes to the Fenway, life as we know it will never be the same.
Never be the same, Jim? Really?
Yes, really, Marjorie.
Okay. Then Charlie Baker on a new and very discouraging poll for his fellow Republicans in the race to succeed John Kerry in the United States Senate. Plus, Tiger Woods reclaimed the top spot in golf this weekend. Were you cheering him on or not? All that and more up next on 89.7 WGBH. Brody, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
As every single one of you knows, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments this morning on whether gays and lesbians have a constitutional right to marry. That's Prop 8 out of California, something that could transform the law nationwide. And tomorrow, the oral argument is on the Defense of Marriage Act, which is a federal law signed by Bill Clinton, by the way, which denies federal benefits even to those same-sex couples which are legally married. But, you know, before we get to the merits and the likely outcome, there's a side story in the New York Times today, Marjorie, that I just love, how some firms are charging $50 an hour for somebody to hold a place for you in line so you have a chance
terrible.
To get inside to hear oral arguments. $1,200 a day.
Yeah, and they got there on Thursday. So think of these people that got there like Thursday night, you know, that are legitimate people standing
$3,600.
Outside. Apparently the first or second people in line had really no idea what they were standing there for, what the cases the cases were involved. It seemed very unfair.
You know, if this GBH thing doesn't work out for us, I can see a Jim and Marjorie's Placeholders, Inc. Can you see that?
You just get your overalls on, your umbrella, and you stand out there in the slush and the rain.
I could do it. Joining us to talk through what's at stake if Prop 8 is upheld or struck down are Andrew Beckwith. He's the vice president of the Massachusetts Family Institute. Good morning, Andrew. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Sue O'Connell, a regular here, is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
So we just finished the oral arguments, but let's just jump ahead and get your predictions. First, you, Andrew, what do you think is going to happen with Prop 8 and what's going to happen with DOMA tomorrow that's going to be argued tomorrow?
Sure. Well, obviously no one knows for sure, and they'll be dissecting the questions and comments from the judges as we go forward. But at stake in both these cases is the public purpose of marriage. And that is, we at Mass Family, we believe, to unite men and women to each other and to the children they produce. And we hope that the court will uphold that definition.
And shaking your head already, Sue.
No, I'm just thinking about from a sort of objective standpoint, from the actual law of what's going on. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and think that the Supreme Court is going to decide that there isn't really any standing for those in Prop 8 and DOMA to fight it, that there's nobody fighting that Prop 8 should exist.
Which would allow the lower court ruling to stand, which ruled that Prop 8 was unconstitutional.
And DOMA, Obama administration has decided not to fight DOMA, to allow things to kind of go forward, and there's a Republican group that's arguing it. So, this is not a standard conventional wisdom idea, but I think that they might come out and say there's no standing for the battle.
Well, before we continue with Sue and Andrew, on the line with us is Mary Bonato. Mary Bonato is from Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders. She was also the lead counsel in the Goodrich case, which obviously before the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts was the one that established gay marriage as a constitutional right. Mary, what was the argument like inside the Supreme Court building?
It was, full of high drama, as you would expect. The court asked really tough questions of both sides, but there was some agreement. There was some agreement around the issue that marriage is important. There was agreement around the issue that marriage is important to kids, and particularly we're flagging the issue of the kids of same-sex parents who want their parents to be able to be married. And there were some very interesting exchanges in response to the whole idea of the purpose of marriage. Some people happen to think love and commitment have something to do with it, and, of course, the responsible procreation argument is that it's all biological reproduction. So there were some really tough questions, I thought, around, well, what if you just had a ban at age 55? No intrusive questions, just an age limitation. Would that be constitutional? And I have to say, I think people got bollocks up on the Prop 8 side trying to answer that one.
Hey, Mary, we're talking to Mayor Bonato, who is inside the courtroom. Obviously, what everybody does in these sort of settings is look at the potential swing votes and try to read something into the questions they asked from the litigants. What did you read into the questions that came from the Kennedys and those sorts?
Well, I have to tell you, I think there were, for the most part, all of the justices asked questions that could be construed as helpful to each side. There were two exceptions to that that don't need to be named. But, you know, so there were, for the most part, the questions were really cutting in both directions. And that's why I say, you know, on the purpose of marriage piece and the, you know, sterility test, everybody wanted an answer to that question. How is Mr. Cooper going to answer that question? And, you know, he went off in the direction of basically saying it helps, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but helps somehow prevent infidelity if you have this public purpose of marriage. So in any event, there were also a lot of questions, I'm sure this has already been raised, about standing and jurisdiction.
Yes.
How is it that these people who propose a ballot initiative, you know, A, get to stand in for the state, and then B, given that, you know, the federal courts are very careful about who gets through the door, you normally need to show that you are personally injured in a way that other people are not. And even if you feel very strongly about the issue, why is it that these particular ballot proponents would have some sort of, you know, unique injury that's different from other people who, in California, people who voted for Prop 8? So lots of attention on that piece as well. But again, on the, you know, the court spent much more time on the merits than it spent on standing. It just wanted to, I think, address standing as a threshold issue.
Mary, Marjorie Egan here. I just wondered, we've made much of the fact that people have been standing outside the court since Thursday. I mean, by the time the top 50 get in there, it must have been a bedraggled lot in that courtroom. Did you see these poor people have been outside since Thursday?
You know, I did. And I have to say, like, the people who waited the longest got the worst seats.
I know.
I hear you.
I'm going to file a suit about that. I'm going to go to the Supreme Court about that.
No, they were in the very back, but, you know, at least they got in. And, you know, there were so many people who wanted to hear who couldn't hear. But as you know, the court is releasing the transcript today at 1 o'clock. So they acknowledge, you know, they rightly acknowledge there's enormous public interest in these cases.
Mary Bonato from Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, this last question from me, is what did it feel? I mean, obviously, you're a major player in the history of this issue for years and years. What did it feel like to be there realizing that the fate of this issue may be in the hands, well, is in the hands of those nine men and women? What was it like for you?
Well, you know, in Massachusetts, when we filed our case, I had a hard time meeting anybody who ever thought we would win or take it seriously. It just seemed absurd, even though, again, we're just talking about people joining in marriage, and marriage has changed plenty of times to, you know, be more capacious and include more people. But in any event, getting to this day today, it's so wonderful to see, and this case is just evidence of it, that we're having a national conversation about this issue. And, you know, I work in all the New England states, and to see the numbers of people who were in one place 5 years ago but have changed their minds now, because in the end, when you actually see what it looks like when couples are married, it takes down the temperature, and you see that there's these people who love each other, they want to commit to each other, they want to be there for each other over the long haul, and why in the world as a society wouldn't we want to encourage that kind of commitment? And then when you throw kids in, why exactly does it advantage any kid to tell their parents that they can't get married?
Jim, hey, I just want to say that Mary Bonato will be remembered as one of the greatest lawyers of our time. I mean, she's being very humble, as she always is, but, you know, her arguments and the number of times that, you know, she's been at the Supreme Court in one way or another, and the way that she has really taken this argument into a complete way that people can understand and that judges can understand, you know, 50 years from now, Mary's going to be remembered in quite high standing.
Quite a send-off. Mary Bonato was inside, now she's outside. Mary, thanks so much for calling. We really appreciate
it. Thank you.
By the way, we expect to hear from Chris Mino, who is Andrew's boss, who was at a rally on the National Mall, obviously on the other side of the issue, the president of the Mass Family Institute. We hope he's going to call in.
And we are talking with Andrew Beckwith, who's the vice president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, and Sue O'Connell, the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Andrew, it's going to be tough for you in some ways because the tide does seem to be turning. You look at the polls on gay marriage. People that were just outraged by it 10 and 20 years ago are changing their mind. Young people are changing their mind. Do you ever feel like you're banging your head against the wall here, especially in Massachusetts?
Well, look, I mean, a lot of those polls depend upon how the questions are asked. But I would actually agree with Mary that this is a national conversation that we're having. And we hope that the court doesn't cut that conversation, that debate short, by striking down either Proposition 8 or DOMA. Because if they uphold both of those laws, they return the policymaking authority for marriage to the voters and their elected officials. And that will allow this national conversation to play out naturally and hopefully reach some consensus.
You know, this Cooper guy, who's the lawyer for the Proposition 8 side, I heard, at least in the state court, they were playing on this station this morning, some of his arguments. Mm-hmm. And he kept talking about the people are sovereign. When the people have spoken, nine unelected judges, I know you've heard of this, should not get between the people and the laws or constitutions they choose to put in place. What's your response on that?
Well, I have three things. One, I hate ballot questions for everyone. You know, I think the original intent of the ballot question has gone way off the rails. Second, I hate California's ballot questions. They go back and forth and back and forth, pro and con. But most importantly, I think that whenever conservatives lose, if they lose at the ballot box, they say it's not the people's right to say. If they lose in the judicial system, they say they're activist judges. So, you know, it does. What we're
By the way, liberals did that after Bush v. Gore, I should say,
yeah,
in 2000.
No, I didn't. I didn't say it, actually, because I firmly believe that it's, you know, you have these two paths to making laws, and they kind of balance each other. And certainly we've wanted to have same-sex marriage be legal a lot quicker. But we are seeing a mix of elected officials who are for same-sex marriage, like President Barack Obama, who got reelected. So one would imagine that the folks are going along with that. So I just think it's a false argument.
And the number's 877-301-8970. If you want to weigh in on day one of oral argument or day two tomorrow, which will be DOMA Day at Supreme Court, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970.
You know, Andrew, you're the one guy in the room. I mean, obviously, Sue is pro-gay marriage. Jim and I are pro-gay
Not
marriage.
Not married, though.
Not
Still
married.
Single.
That, you make that point every time you come on. It's become like the match.com here at WGBH. But anyway, many people who are pro-gay marriage have made the argument you're making that it would be better to let the natural course of things go because, obviously, more and more states are approving gay marriage, even at the ballot box. Would that, if it were done that way, sort of organically instead of through the courts, would that make your side feel any better about this?
Well, I think if you take a fully democratic process, it's going to take time. And, you know, if nothing else, our side will at least know that we've had a chance to develop the arguments and make our case heard. But, you know, speaking of time, speaking of history, to answer your question earlier, first of all, I think I'm not afraid of the history argument because the case for traditional family has basically all of recorded history on its side, as it were, demonstrating the effectiveness of mothers and fathers as the fundamental building block of society. But on the other side, we really don't know what the long-term repercussions of same-sex marriage will be.
Well, the American Society of Pediatrics the other day said after a four-year study that they do. It's not a century-long study, but they came down on this issue, which a lot of people think was a pretty pivotal moment.
Well, I can tell you the last time that we tinkered this dramatically with the definition of marriage was with the no-fault divorce laws, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And if you look at the state of marriage now as a consequence, that, to me, should be a warning for doing the same thing with same-sex marriage.
You know, I'm going to get back to one thing Marjorie said to you, Andrew. Everybody is citing polls, and you are totally right that obviously it's how you ask the question. But when there are margins like this, 18 to 29-year-olds in this recent, I think it was Washington Post poll, 4 out of 5 of them supported gay marriage. So the reality is, let's assume for argument's sake that for you, you are right. The reality is the train is leaving the station. And at some point, this is a question, not a statement, by the way.
Okay.
And at some point, there's going to be, even if they rule the way you want Supreme Court to rule, there'll be another set of Supreme Court justices. There'll be those 18 to 29-year-olds are going to be 38 to 49-year-olds. At some point, you're going to lose this argument, even if you don't lose it in June on DOMA and Prop 8. Do you agree with that?
Well, no, I don't. You know, no surprise there. But if you look at this situation, you kind of compare it to where you know, the abortion decision Roe v. Wade was 40 years ago. Look at the polls of young people now; they're actually more pro-life. So, as society sees the consequences of these, you know, radical, as we see radical policies, we believe that the truth will win out in the end. So it may take 40 years, but that's why we want to have an ongoing discussion, not have the court shut it down.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's take a call or two for Sue and Andrew. We're going to Matt in Plymouth. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Matt.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great.
Well, I just think it's a silly discussion nationally. I figure if the United States of America has laws that allow people to get married, that goes for all people. It doesn't matter what kind of people. And on the other hand, if a same-sex couple wants to adopt children and have a family, they should be able to be married and have that family. That's about it for me.
Well, Matt, thank you. That was a variation on, I guess, Ted Olson's argument for the Supreme Court.
He could go to the Supreme Court and argue that. That would work perfectly.
You know, Andrew, I think when you were on my television show, I asked you a question. I'm going to ask you again.
All right.
One of the most dramatic moments in the Goodrich thing was when the couple, subsequently divorced, by the way, went and saw Mitt Romney, who opposed gay marriage. And I'm going to paraphrase. Sue, you'll correct me, I think, if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. And one of the couple said to Mitt Romney, what do you say to our kid about this? And I can't remember what the answer was.
He basically said, well, you should have thought of that before.
Is that what he
said? Decided to become a parent.
But okay, but now let's make it much more concrete. I know Sue's kid quite well. She always tracks with her when Sue comes to NECN to be on my show. What do you say to her kid or kids like Ruby if they were here today? What do you say to them?
Sure. Well, I'll talk about my kids. I have three of them. I have a beautiful young daughter.
Talk to my kid. I mean, you have my permission to do that. You can go ahead and talk to my kid.
I love my daughter very much, and I look forward tonight to going home and tucking her into bed. But no matter how much I love her, I will always be her father. I can never be a mother for her. And I guess that is the difference, that if you adopt same-sex marriage as a societal norm, then sort of by definition it says that children do not need both a mother and a father.
What do you say to the children who aren't adopted, who are in foster care, who don't have there aren't different sexed parents who are stepping forward? Those children have no parents. And given the option of having one parent or two parents of the same sex, you're saying what to that child?
Well, first of all, that argument is a false choice because there are, you know, thousands of parents who are in line to adopt children. And specifically here in Massachusetts, you had Catholic Charities, which had an adoption agency, which shut down because of same-sex marriage.
But what would you say to a child that doesn't...
Well, let him finish the thought, Sue. I'm sorry. Andrew?
Well, just saying that same-sex marriage in Massachusetts actually hurt the adoption industry because Catholic Charities had to pull out of that rather than face lawsuits because of their religious beliefs.
But what would you say to a child who had a choice between no parent and a gay parent?
I think that's a false choice.
No, it isn't. It certainly comes up from time to time. There are certainly... children out there who are up for adoption who may only have maybe, let's say, the top five choices are just gay parents and they have to go down the line.
I mean, that's hypothetical. I don't think reflects reality. There are thousands of parents waiting patiently. I have friends who are waiting patiently to adopt children from all over the world. And again, the argument is that the ideal for children is to have a mother and a father. But I would ask you, what would you tell those children? Which parent do they not need, the mother or the father?
Believe me, as a single parent, not by choice, I'm all for two parents. I'm actually all for four parents. I'm all for ten parents.
That's where we're going.
I think you also see, though, and I live in Brookline, where it seems like half the town is gay and they've all raised children. And my children grew up with all the children of gay kids who have done exceedingly well. As a matter of fact, I interviewed the captain of the Brookline football team, who's about 6'7". His mother is two mothers, and he talked about what wonderful parents they were to him. And he's straight, and he's gone on to be a great Ivy League educated kid and stuff like that. I think the point is that these kids, for the most part, so far, are doing great. And I think part of it is there's such enormous pressure, and you could address
lesbians
and gays
absolutely.
To be a super parent.
I love it when I get, just as we all do, the criticism from your friends about how you're parenting. I mean, everybody gets that.
Right.
I get to say, I've been okayed. I've been interviewed by a social worker. I've had a home visit. I got followed up on. But the bigger issue is, we get off base on this. Where in the United States Constitution does it say that a man and a woman are getting married just to have a baby? Where does it say that in the United States? How many times does the United States Constitution, which is what we're talking about today, we're in front of the United States Supreme Court, how many times do we talk about that a man and a woman get married to have a baby, and that's the only way it can be. Where
Andrew,
does it say
that? Do you
want
to respond to that before we get back to the Coles?
Yeah, I mean, just quickly, in the Constitution, I would ask, where does it say, for example, with DOMA, that the Congress somehow does not have the constitutional authority to define marriage for the purpose of federal benefits?
I would say for DOMA,
and federal programs.
States,
I mean,
DOMA is an overreach of states' rights. I mean, there's absolutely it overreaches
all it does
in a way.
All it does is define marriage for federal programs and federal benefits, and it ensures that states do not have their marriage laws altered by those of other states.
But it's a complete overreach. You
how
know?
So?
Because it
affects
basically
federal programs
it's
and federal
telling states how they can and cannot do. If this were Obamacare, the conservatives would be absolutely crazy that the federal government was telling them how to define something.
Let's go back to the
call. One thing before we get back to the calls, I was startled when I read the briefs in the DOMA situation that many of them come from retired military generals, brigadier generals, vice admirals talking about how the lack of recognition of same-sex marriages in the military is affecting cohesion. It's a complete 180 from what they did before, because if you are a service member and your spouse dies, you get none of those benefits. You don't get to meet the casket coming off the airplane. I was stunned that West Point and the United States Coast Guard Academy have a gay, lesbian, transgendered,
absolutely,
and bisexual support group. West Point. So you say to yourself,
boots on the ground,
this is not
it.
The West Point that
many of us know. No, the boots on the ground, get it.
Yeah, the
people
boots on the
live
ground. And the companies, I mean, mm-hmm, Walt Disney,
Raytheon,
Citigroup.
Now, which is an interesting point, Marja, because one of the legal arguments for providing protection to same-sex attracted individuals is that they are somehow discriminated against, you know, underprivileged minority. And that's one of the qualifications for protection under the Constitution.
It's not an argument that they're making so much, though, in the Supreme Court.
Of course they're not, because look at, I mean, they have a lot of power and influence.
So we're powerful, so we get to be discriminated
against. Let's go back to the calls, by the way.
You don't need the court's protection.
Well, we do need the court's protection because we're discriminated against. I mean, it's basically nowhere in the Constitution is marriage defined. Okay. Nowhere in the Constitution is you have to have a man and a woman married to have a child. Nowhere. You may read it in your Bible, and that is, I would fight to the death for you to have that and hold that opinion.
Here we go. Death match on the Gretchen Brown issue.
Okay, that's the voice of Andrew Beckwith.
Right. Jell-O fight.
He's the vice president of Mass Family Institute.
Duel?
And Sue O'Connell is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. We promise we'll get to your calls. We're going to get to your calls. Let's go to Tim in Newburyport. You're on with Sue and Andrew on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Tim.
Hi, guys. I can boil this down. This is a big, giant issue, and I can boil it down to the separation of church and state. I'm over 60 years old. I have voted since I was 18. I have watched politics. I have watched the functioning of our government for the last 45 years anyways. And what I see is a dangerous mixture of religion and politics, religion and government, if you will. And these are rights that are granted in our Constitution, and because these rights tend to go against people's religious beliefs, there's no standing there. We have separation of church and state in this country, and to come to me and argue on religious grounds, yep, that marriage is this, and it can't be that because my Bible or my religion says it's this, or my religion says you get married to procreate, it's all invalid.
Yep.
It's all, as they say in legal terms, a fatal flaw.
Hey, Tim.
Tim, we got it. We got it.
Thanks
Thank
for
you
the call.
Very much for the call.
Okay.
What
can
do you
I
say
respond
to
that? Sure.
Well,
first of all, talking
Andrew
about what is and is not in the Constitution, the term separation of church and state, as you recognize, it was not in the Constitution. In fact, there is reference to being endowed by our Creator with the very rights that Tim is talking about. So, you know, banishing any sort of religious ideas or faith backgrounds from public discourse and from law, I think, is fundamentally flawed and doesn't reflect the intent of the founding fathers. But again, on this issue, you don't need to necessarily reach back to the Bible or a faith background to make your arguments. It's about what is best for children. One of the most recent thorough studies by Mark Regnerus at the University of Texas showed that children of same-sex parents do not, in a series of categories, do not fare as well as similarly situated children. You got to do the right kind of comparisons.
But you know, you're comparing, if I may, one person's research to the Academy of Pediatrics, whose mission it is to deal with kids.
You're bearing false witness, Andrew.
If I can, Andrew, you know, also, it seems that when you mention the whole kid thing, I think one of the most significant things is not just these corporations coming out on this. Rob Portman was concerned about kids. and gay marriage and the threat, he's a senator from Ohio, posed to children until he found out his own son was gay. And then all of a sudden, he's the only Republican in the United States Senate who supports gay marriage. That, to me, spoke such volumes. It was epic. I mean, what was your reaction to that? Beyond the fact you disagree with him. I mean, my kid is gay, so I'm now for gay marriage. Until I knew he was gay, I was against gay marriage.
Well, it's an interesting decision-making process for him. Obviously, very emotional and personal.
But, Andrew,
personal.
You know, if you read these polls, as I know you do, almost every person says the thing that caused them to flip, if they were against gay marriage and then they changed to four, was because they met someone or found out that someone who they knew well was gay. And then it changed the dynamic dramatically. In any case, let's go back to the calls. David in Arlington, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, David.
Hi. First, I think you need to make a correction. You were talking about a gay and lesbian group at the Coast Guard Academy, and you were referring to it as being in West Point, where, of course, the military academy
is. Two different ones.
Coast Guard is at New London, Connecticut.
Right. Well, there are two different ones, David. One's at West Point, one's at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy.
Oh, there's one at the military academy too, huh?
Yes, yes.
Anyhow, that's not why I called. I called to ask if you think that a decision in today's case will encourage future cases involving perhaps plural marriage or marriage to a sibling or something like that. Do you think there's a slippery slope there?
Andrew, you want to take that one?
Well, I mean, we already see there are cases in the court systems now about plural marriage. I think one of those reality TV shows, Sister Wives or something like that. But some of the participants in that show have actually already brought suit using the very same legal arguments. Because if you take marriage as the union of one man and one woman for life, and then you take away the man-woman part, right? If men and women are interchangeable, then why not continue to tinker with it and take away the one in one? Why not one in three? If it's about who you love and be free to who you love, what if you love two people?
Sue?
This is one of those great arguments. I don't care. You know, I mean, what I care about is the same-sex marriage argument right now. Andrew and others make the point that marriage has never changed. Well, marriage has been a dynamic change in Western culture forever. I mean, women were property of men. Women couldn't own things. I mean, that's changed, has it not, Andrew?
We're talking about the fundamental mother,
so anyway,
father, and children.
Well, in Western culture, there have been men that have women who have raised children as a group while the men went off to sea or men went out to work. It was still defined as marriage. There's also been the Saxon definition of marriage, which didn't happen until usually the woman was pregnant and they got pregnant and then the town decided. I mean, there's a great history of Western marriage, which is not just narrowly defined as what it is today. You would outlaw marriage. You would outlaw divorce if you could, wouldn't you?
That's not the issue right
here. But you would, right? Your organization would work to outlaw divorce if you could.
That's a fair question, Andrew, isn't it? Man, what's a totally
you've said
fair
it before.
Question.
I mean, you've said it on the air before that you.
Well, I haven't said that. But
well, Chris has said it, that you would work.
Chris Mino, who runs the organization.
Would outlaw divorce if you could.
No-fault divorce, I think, has brought great harm to our society, and especially to the children who oftentimes suffer the most from it. Historically, before no-fault divorce, you had to have specific reasons for divorce: abuse, infidelity.
So it would be a narrow definition of divorce for you. And how do you feel about...
Look, if you make a commitment to another... if a man makes a commitment to a woman and vice versa, and especially if there's potential for children to be involved, that should be a lifelong commitment.
And how do you feel about interfaith marriages? Do you feel that people of different faiths should be able to marry?
Yes.
Okay.
One more call before we let these people go. And by the way, we're going to return to this with the DOMA oral argument tomorrow, so don't feel deprived. Let's go to Jack and Holden. You're on with Jim, Marjorie, Andrew, and Sue. We'll get 1 second,
sure.
Andrew. Go ahead. Jack, take it away.
Yeah, hi. Can
you hear
me? I wanted to respond to something. Is it Andrew with the family organization?
Yes, it is, sir. Andrew, yes.
I think I heard you say some time ago that the court should both uphold Proposition 8 and uphold DOMA, both on the principle that this would further, you know, keeping the decision-making about this issue in the state and the state legislatures, as opposed to having the court impose a solution. Now, I agree with you on Proposition 8. There's a good argument to be made that maybe the court...
Hey, Jack, this is a horrible connection, so if you can cut to the bottom line. I don't mean to be impolite, but we have trouble hearing you. No, it's not your fault. Go to your question, if you would.
Okay, my question is, I disagree with what you said about DOMA, because I think, in fact, DOMA cuts against states' rights to define what marriage is, because they're very important federal rights, property rights, that are being denied people who have married and are not being given effect.
Okay, Jack, thanks so much. It was hard to hear you. I'm sorry.
Sure,
go ahead,
and
Andrew.
Then the proper path for, you know, amending DOMA, if that's what you want to do, is to go through Congress the same way as passed. And I just want to ask Sue, since you're asking me a series of questions.
Yeah.
So are you on record today, then, supporting polygamy?
No, I don't know
enough. Do you think
there's
anything wrong with polygamy?
I don't know enough about polygamy to make an opinion.
Do you think it's okay for a man to marry two women or a woman to marry two men?
I don't have any moral objection to it.
Okay.
It's not in my, you know, it's in the Bible, so it must be okay.
I'd love to have some more Bible discussions.
But you know, that's not what's before that. That used to be the argument that we would hear 10 years ago.
But I don't have enough information.
But that, I think you'll hear it more.
You think Cooper
is going to argue that before the Supreme Court?
But it's not an equal rights argument, because no one...
No, that's the exact same argument that's being made.
No, it's not. Let Marjorie finish the thought.
Polygamy is outlawed for everybody, unless I'm missing something somewhere. And marriage is not outlawed for everybody. So to me, it's
true.
It depends on the definition of marriage, though. It depends on the definition of marriage.
Well, no one can marry four people.
Well, most of the states say two people. Marriage between two people. So the state constitutions actually do define what marriage is in existing law. And that's what the argument is.
On that note,
we have
Andrew
to go.
Beckwith, what did you say? We have to go, Sue?
I got all confused.
Yeah, I said, no, we could spend all day.
Andrew,
you're
Beckwith,
a good sport, because the poor guy is he's here by himself, outnumbered by all of us.
Mass Family Institute is Andrew Beckwith. Sue O'Connell is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Gentlemen and lady, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Okay, coming up is another issue, which is dividing people with the same sort of passion and furor. We've just seen evidence here. It's Wegmans versus Whole Foods. Wegmans is coming to the Fenway. What do you think? That's next on Boston Public Radio.
You are listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, from the sublime to the ridiculous. You know, we barely recovered, Marjorie, from the Shake Shack shockwaves that have been reverberating throughout Boston. Now we find out that a Wegmans supermarket is slated to open in the Fenway. So we want to talk why the excitement about this supermarket chain. Joining us on the line is someone who's very qualified to talk about it. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. His name is David Rode. He's reported from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, and from Rochester, New York, the headquarters of Wegmans, where he researched his great piece for The Atlantic. It's called The Anti-Walmart, The Secret Sauce of Wegmans is People. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, David.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
I just have to ask you, because Jim just listed your resume, which is very impressive. You've been a war correspondent. What has been your most popular article, or second most popular article, I should say, David, in your whole career?
In my entire career, yes, it's the anti-Walmart. It's the Wegmans piece. It was in 22,000 likes. It went viral immediately when it appeared, and I was shocked. And it's all due to my little brother.
Oh, your little brother? Why?
Lived or worked in Rochester or something?
Yes, my little brother went to school in Rochester, and visiting him one time, he was sort of, it's like a, see, people are going to get mad at me if I say a cult, but there's fierce loyalty to Wegmans. He loves it. And so I was writing about foreign affairs, but also about the middle class worldwide, and clearly the American middle class has been struggling. But this was an example of a business that treated its employees well. And that's what led me there.
That was one of the greatest things, which I didn't realize about Wegmans. Tell people about how they do treat their employees. It's so unusual in 2013.
It may sound, hard to believe, but they bar cashiers from interacting with their customers unless they have 40 hours of training. They send hundreds of staffers overseas to become experts about their products. They have no mandatory retirement age, and they've never laid off workers in their history.
How great is that?
It sounds crazy. There is a catch here, and they're not perfect. Where they make their money is by high volume. They have these enormous stores, which I'm sure the one in Fenway will be. And they really try to turn over, merchandise and sell a lot of stuff very quickly. And in defense of Walmart, they did have high prices in the past, but as Walmart opened up its supermarket operations, it forced Wegmans to get more competitive price-wise.
We're talking to David Rode, who did visit the Wegmans, thanks to his brother. What we haven't talked about with you is the zen of the food at Wegmans. What was it like when you walked through the doors? I assume it was the usual 120,000 square feet or whatever it was. Prepared foods to die for. What was it like for you?
I mean, it's similar to the Whole Foods effect, where there's just everything you can imagine, the sort of produce, you know, the bright colors greet you when you immediately get there. The difference was, though, that I was impressed with how much employees know. There was a guy at the meat counter who had visited, you know, different ranches in the western U.S. where his steak had come from. The guy selling fish was sort of raving about this, you know, fish they just gotten in from Alaska. And people, you know, and again, it's not a perfect place, but these employees were really happy.
Well, you also talked about the bakery. Tell people about the bakery. I found this amazing.
They had a bakery there, which was run by a woman who'd worked there for 38 years. She basically started doing the baking because she made great homemade Italian cookies. And the person who, Rob Wegman, who runs it now, his father and uncle started the business, he loved these cookies. So she was able to start baking full time, and they've, you know, created this huge bakery operation in all their stores.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you want to speak to David about his experience, or if you've had one, either at the Wegmans in Northborough, which was the first store in Massachusetts, or one of the other, I guess, 80-some throughout the country. I have to say, on our former radio show, David, maybe a year or two ago when Northborough opened, we took calls, not for a few minutes, but for hours. We talked to people who planned their wedding inside a Wegmans because that's where they had met the person they fell in love with. The most almost orgasmic discussions about the quality of the prepared food. I'm a big Whole Foods guy. I have never heard people talk about a supermarket like they talk about this. So what is the experience itself? Beyond the food, beyond how great the employees are, what do you feel like when you walk in the building?
I guess it's I want people to call who'll say bad things about Wegmans. I don't want to just be a shill here for the company.
Okay.
You don't feel as rushed. I mean, it's simple things. It's, you know, they immediately fill ad cashiers when the lines are long in the area.
That's huge, David. Huge.
It's this idea that if there's happy employees, it leads to happy customers and this sort of infectious atmosphere. I know they can't be perfect. One thing they argue, and given the way businesses run these days, that they say the reason they can do it is because they're a privately run, family-owned company. And they specifically talked about not being forced to please demands from the stock market, not being forced to sort of increase, to grow too quickly. Their goal is to never open more than one store a year. Otherwise, I think they'll dilute their quality.
You know, you said you didn't want there to be a love fest, David, but I hate to disappoint you. A high school in Massachusetts last year produced a musical called Wegmans the Musical. And you'll get to hear one of the songs. This is to the tune, people will recognize it, of Seasons of Love from Rent. Listen up, if you would.
How do you measure the variety here? In cheeses, in produce, in bakers, types of coffee, in apple, pecan, and blueberry pie. 525,600 items. So much to choose from. How do I decide? One, two, where?
Again, that's from Wegmans Musical. We're talking to David Rode, who visited a Wegmans. There is one in Northborough. There's one coming to Route 9 in Chestnut Hill. And there is one coming to the Fenway. Our mayor announced it yesterday. Let's go to Paul in Milton. Paul, you were first with Jim, Marjorie, and David Rode. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Jim. How are you again?
Excellent, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Real question. I hope Wegmans is environmentally sound. I've got a problem with a large chain that asks you to, you know, stop and buy. They're trying to get a paper bag Stop and Shop. You're trying to get, you know, paper and plastic or just paper bags has become next to impossible with Stop and Shop. And I've gone round and round with them, and apparently they're giving quotas to these stores, and they're forcing you into these environmentally destructive plastic bags, unless you bring your own fiber bags. I hope Wegmans. Does anybody know Wegmans?
Yeah,
well, I assume
Paul.
David will
yeah,
go.
Yeah, David. Thank you, Paul. What's the answer? Are we going environment? Are we green at Wegmans or not, David?
I will be honest. I don't know. I don't know. I would think they would do that, but that's a very good question for people to know. And one complaint, and I'm happy to have one thing to say. Wegmans the prices are low, but they're still seen as targeting sort of upper middle class and wealthy consumers, and that they have closed some of their stores that were in poorer neighborhoods in Rochester, New York, where they got their start. So, you know, there's an argument that this is sort of unbelievable service for you know, the affluent. But I don't have a good answer on the environmental question.
Well, David,
you've
said a couple of times that things were less than perfect. That's one example. Is there anything else we should know on the downside about Wegmans before we get in line for 2 days before it opens in the Fenway?
I not that I know of. I should have, you know. And if I ask my brother, he'll say, you know, there's nothing.
You know, David, Marjorie was undecided. Would she stand in line for 3 nights for the Supreme Court argument on DOMA tomorrow?
That's right.
Or would she stand in line at Wegmans at the Fenway? And you can imagine what she decided. Let's go to Joe in Boston. You are next with David Rode. We're talking about Wegmans coming to the Fenway. Hey, Joe.
Hello, friends. How are you?
Excellent. Great. Thanks for the call.
Good, good. I live in the area, and I just wanted to comment on how I've never been to a Wegmans, but I'm just super excited that they made the decision to bring one here. One thing I would urge people to consider are the traffic considerations that they'd want to try and mitigate. You know, I can just imagine people doing their shopping at the end of a Sox game on a July evening and how that's going to affect. And as well with the Route 9 location. And then the other two quick points I just wanted to make is how the Back Bay Fenway area has become just such an antithesis of a food desert, and how amazing the choices around here are. I just wanted to make those 2 points.
Joe, thank you very much for the call. Our numbers, by the way, are 877-301-8970 if you are ranting or raving about Wegmans, or if you've been there and from Northborough and have a report for us. Our email address is BPR, that's in Boston Public Radio, at WGBH.org. You know, we should point out that the Wegmans that's coming to Boston is not going to be right next to Fenway Park. Well, it's going to be close. It's going to be in the Landmark Center.
Still pretty congested area, and Route 9 is congested now, long before Wegmans.
And one of the things I hate about the Landmark Center, of course, they make you pay to park in there, and I find that very, very upsetting. David, do you know where we're talking about in Boston, the near Fenway Park, the Landmark Center, where the Wegmans is planned to be going, and also in Chestnut Hill on Route 9?
I do know it, and I actually remember I talked to them about where they were going to expand, and I talked about going to the Boston market. It'll be interesting to see how consumers in Boston respond to Wegmans. They saw Boston as very, very competitive in terms of the existing supermarket chain, and they were very curious to see how they're going to fare in the Boston market. Because of congestion, the key to their success is these huge stores. Will that work in the Boston area? And B, you know, it is a very competitive environment. And how do I say this politely, you know? Bostonians know their food.
Oh, that's polite.
And I'm not saying that people in Rochester don't, but let's see how Bostonians react.
Well, actually, you know, bring you up to speed on something, David. They are making an accommodation. The store in Northborough, which is sort of out
in the
suburbs, I was trying to be kind there, too, 120,000 square feet. I think the store on both Route 9 in Chestnut Hill and the one planned for the Fenway is closer to 70,000 square feet. And I think I've read that they are probably the smallest scale stores they've done. They're basically experimenting to see how they can do in urban areas. So, David, before we let you go, what was your favorite food when you went to Rochester? What was the thing you left with and you said, oh, my God, it doesn't get any better than that?
The homemade Italian cookies. I brought them to my wife and my daughter, and they absolutely loved them. And you're right about the size. The flagship store is 135,000 feet.
Oh, that's massive.
And they're typically 80,000, 120,000 feet. And a key thing is that they usually feature 70,000 products. That's twice the number available in a standard grocery store.
David, before you go, I got to ask this question. I know you only have 60 seconds left. You were a captive of the Taliban for months. Do you ever, you lie in bed after you'd go to the Wegmans, you say, I was captured by the Taliban and held hostage for 7 months, and today I'm in a 130,000 square foot supermarket in Rochester. Do you appreciate the something of that, David?
So I do, and I'll, this is a bizarre story, but it's completely true. We live very close to Whole Foods here in New York City.
Yeah.
And the sad thing about, you know, life of the Taliban is that they brainwash all these young guys to focus on their next life. And they say it's all about becoming martyrs and dying. It's very sad, to be blunt, and I know this sounds a little odd. There was no focus on this world and how can we make our lives better? How can we help each other more? And it was I literally did walk into the Whole Foods that I sometimes found over the top before the kidnapping. I walked into it after coming home from the kidnapping and said, you know, this is what makes us great in some ways, that we try to innovate, try to find ways to help each other. And that, again, hats off to Wegmans for treating its employees well and setting a great example for other businesses.
I love that you said it, David. That was great, David.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. David Rohde is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, columnist for Reuters, and he has been a war correspondent. His forthcoming book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. Thanks so much for being with us, David. And I want to point out that Wegmans also has a couple things we haven't mentioned, Jim. A comfort food bar with things like baked chicken and mashed potatoes and meatloaf. They have their own burrito maker. They have an Indian food bar. They have dim sum, Thai food, a wokery, freshly baked pieces at a little restaurant called The Food Bar. This is Brian McGroy writing in the Boston Globe, that turns out seared scallops that look like they could be served at L'Espalier.
So, well, you didn't read the best line from Brian's column. Brian will be with us tomorrow at 1 o'clock. May I read that?
Certainly.
He said in the middle of his column that he wrote a couple of years ago when it opened in Northborough, if food is our last vice, Wegmans is the ultimate house of ill repute. Pretty good line from Brian McGraw. We'll ask him about it tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Okay. Thank you very much for David, for being with us. You've heard a lot. We've just been talking about this, the so-called wealth gap in America and wealth gaps in supermarkets and the different ones all around town. I bet you haven't heard much about the word gap. We're going to talk to you about the word gap up next on Boston Public Radio.
How long have we been hearing that breastfeeding is best, both for mom and child, but how long have we known that it still isn't easy?
Babies pretty much are born equipped to do it, but mothers have to learn how to do it.
We'll talk about efforts to support breastfeeding, where they are succeeding and where they are falling short. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum, presenting Paint Things, exploring the space between painting and sculpture, on view through April 21st. More information at decordova.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. The word gap. You ever heard of it? Neither had we. But here to explain it to us and why it matters is the Globe's language columnist. He's featured on Sundays in the Ideas section. Welcome back, Ben Zimmer.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Pleasure.
Hi, Ben. So what is the word gap, and why does it matter?
Well, the word gap comes from a study that was done by child psychologists. It came out back in 1995. And they tried to cover children in their first few years of life. And they recorded how talk was made around them, basically. So the kind of language that a child is exposed to just growing up, just sort of soaking all of that in. And they found some startling results when you look at sort of lower income versus higher income families, where children in the lower income group were hearing far fewer words over the course of the day, and if you extrapolate that up through the first 3 years of life, they calculated that there was this 30 million word gap between sort of low income and higher income families. And the why is that important? Well, it ends up correlating very strongly with future success of the kids in school, sort of if measuring academic achievement. They kept following the kids to see how they achieved later on. And so it became a very important talking point in early childhood education that there's this word gap that we need to narrow, that children need to be exposed to lots of language, lots of talk that includes parents reading to their kids, but even just having conversations, that is an important part of early childhood development and is crucial, actually, with establishing literacy when the kids enter school, when they enter kindergarten and the early grades. So that if you want to make sure that kids are succeeding and meeting these benchmarks, you have to look at that very earliest time of their life to see the kind of language that they're exposed to in the home.
We're talking with Boston Globe language columnist Ben Zimmer about something called the word gap. Ben, what I don't understand, and straighten me out, please, is okay, so kids in lower income homes hear fewer words, but does that mean that they hear words with less of a range in vocabulary, or are just people at a higher economic level just talking more in general? I mean, and why is that? I don't get that. You know, why people don't talk that much if they're from a blue-collar family or something?
There could be a lot of different reasons for it, obviously. I mean, there could be a lot to do with, families that work may not, have the opportunities to be interacting verbally with their kids as much in terms of just finding hours in the day to do that. Some of it is just sort of cultural, I suppose. But it's sort of the studies that have looked into this, starting with the 1995 study, aren't really talking about the type of language that's being used. It's really an attempt to sort of measure just total word usage or language usage over the course of the day and seeing how important that is for children, especially when they enter school. And so it's not even just a matter of, the types of conversations or things like that, but just finding more opportunities for parents to be speaking with their kids and around their kids, not letting television, for instance, take over for that, which is sometimes the case. A lot of the studies that have been made have found that there's this detrimental effect of just, turning on the TV and having kids exposed to language that way. The sort of the face-to-face interaction of parents or other caregivers with the children is seen as a really important key to success for them in school later on.
We're talking to Ben Zimmer, language columnist for the Boston Globe. In a minute, we're going to talk about your piece, which is Providence's, meaning Rhode Island's, $5 million plan to shrink the word gap. But a couple of things. The television question you just mentioned. I understand. And my mother had a couple of jobs, single parent, only kid, that kind of thing. I'm sitting home. The television was my parent, essentially, for much of my youth. I understand.
It's amazing that you're here, Jim.
Well, I am here. It seems to me if it's a passive activity, meaning the television's on and you're just living your life, that's one thing. But if you're watching the television and listening to the television, as crappy as some of the programs may have been in those days, Ben Zimmer, why doesn't that count when you're making these kinds of, when they are making these kinds of calculations? Why shouldn't it matter?
That's a good question. I have a 6-year-old and I don't ban television in the household when he was growing up. I'm not personally sort of anti-television in that respect. When they are doing these studies, they're looking for certain correlations. And so one thing they might look at is, the number of hours of the kid watching TV versus hours spent, talking to family members and that sort of thing. And there the correlations are they're very strong. It's like if you were able to sort of cut back on the TV time and increase that personal face-to-face human interaction, it has a long-lasting effect. The studies have shown that that's the case. That doesn't mean television is always evil and should never be on.
Understood.
But it's a question, I guess, of finding the right balance and understanding that it can't just be a stand-in for actual, human interaction on a personal level.
Okay, so Ben Zimmer, the consensus seems to be, from having read your piece in the Globe this weekend, is that the scientists say, yeah, it is. There is this correlation. It's not a hypothetical. It's been proven to be there. The bigger the word gap, the bigger the disadvantage the kid is when he or she is in school. Providence thinks it has a solution. Thanks to Mayor Bloomberg, they're getting $5 million to try it out. What's the solution and what's the prospect of success?
Well, they call the program Providence Talks, and as you say, Bloomberg Philanthropies has given it $5 million. That's the grand prize in their mayor's challenge, where they had mayors from around the country proposing ways to help their cities. So Providence won the grand prize. They'll have $5 million to spend on this project, and it's a kind of a high-tech solution in that it involves recording devices that are have been developed by a research foundation out in Boulder, Colorado, the LENA Research Foundation, L-E-N-A. It's an acronym for Language Environmental Analysis. And they took the idea of, you know, what can we do to address the word gap, and said, well, we need to do more studies and understand better the whole language environment that kids are growing up in by recording them and then finding ways to automatically count the number of words that they're exposed to. That 1995 study that I mentioned, they did that all by hand. It was painstaking work going through tens of thousands of pages of transcripts. But now there are automated ways of doing that, of recording kids in their environment for long periods of time, figuring out what language is being used by humans that they're able to screen out, for instance, the television mm-hmm. sounds and other sounds that are not actual words they're being exposed to, and then count them up over the course of the day. And so they're going to use that technology in Providence, and they are going to then put that into a system of a kind of a early childhood intervention program where there's home visitation, and they work with parents. They're going to work with parents on sort of coaching them about how they can find ways to do more with their kids in terms of language and reading and so forth. And so it's an extension of that word gap approach, but doing it more as a way of like bringing this technological approach into people's lives in a useful way so that there can be clear-cut results and improvements in their lives.
So, Ben, the recording devices would be right in the home, correct?
They would actually be on the children themselves.
And close enough to hear. Boy, you'd have to be in your good behavior. Imagine if your kid had a recording device on him all day long. No swearing, no screaming at the spouse. This could be a revolutionary thing, Ben, for the whole family. Because nobody wants, you know, you don't want everybody to know what really goes on behind closed doors.
But then,
you know
what? I get that part of it, even though it seems odd to me. I don't get the how they fix it part. It isn't like, I heard what you said, they're not going to pipe in words from the, you know, like they do at ballpark. So is there a parent who doesn't know without this $5 million, it's good to read to your kid, it's actually good to talk to your kid and engage your kid? So where do they think they're going to get behavioral change because of this program? I'd like to see it happen. I'm just not convinced at all.
I think that parents will understand that that's an important thing on a general abstract level. Whether they're actually putting that into practice is another idea. So basically, what this kind of intervention they want to do in Providence is they would record the language environment of the kids. They would then analyze it and in order to sort of determine, you know, word count, how much conversation is going. They can actually measure how many turns of conversation are happening over the course of the day that they're exposed to, and then present this kind of data to the parents and caregivers and say, hey, this is what's going on. This is where you're at, and this is where you could be at. And it turns out that parents are not a very good judge of if you ask them to say, well, you know, how much language exposure do you think your kid has over the course of the day? Parents tend not to be very good at figuring that out. And so if you're sort of presented with the cold, hard data, that's seen as a way to sort of help them understand, okay, well, this is where you're at, and this is where you could be at, and these are the ways to accomplish that. You know, these are things that you can do to improve the situation.
God, dying to hear if it works. Ben Zimmer, language columnist for the Boston Globe. Great piece, and great to talk to you again, Ben. Thanks.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. He's also the executive producer of Visual Thesaurus.com and Vocabulary.com. That is Ben Zimmer with the Boston Globe. Up next, it is open mic time with Charlie Baker. Up next on Boston Public Radio.
This hour of Boston Public Radio is coming to you fundraiser-free. Thanks to Jessica in Milford.
And Brian and Laura in Swampscott.
And Steve in Worcester.
And the thousands of other WGBH sustainers who keep this station going with small monthly contributions that automatically renew.
When Boston Public Radio can count on your support, you can count on less time fundraising and more Boston Public Radio.
it's easy to sign on as a sustainer.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
And thanks.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Alston community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And 180 days, discover the fight to keep children in class and reform efforts alive inside a challenging school district. 180 days, a year inside an American school, concludes Tuesday at 9 on WGBH2.
You're listening to Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. We're joined on the phone by the former head of Harvard Pilgrim, former Republican candidate for governor in 2010. He joins us on open mic every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Hello there, Charlie Baker.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Excellent.
Great, Charlie. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Marge.
So this new poll by WBUR and Mass Inc. found that a huge chunk of likely voters don't even know who the three Republicans are that are running for John Kerry's seat. Of course, the former U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan, State Rep Dan Winslow, and Gabriel Gomez. This is not great news so close to the primary, is it, Charlie Baker?
I don't know. I mean, I remember people saying the same thing in the Scott Brown-Martha Coakley race in the fall of 2009, too. I do think a lot of people who aren't as sort of crazy about politics as the three of us are tend to come into this stuff pretty late, and my guess is that'll be the case here too. And the other thing I would say is that if you look at all the data in that poll, it's pretty clear that the folks who've had the most sort of visible activities at this point in time, not surprisingly, are the ones who are the most well known. But I wouldn't read too much into it at this point in time, other than people in Massachusetts are probably focused for the most part on other things at this point.
Listen to these numbers, though. If you haven't seen this poll that Marjorie just mentioned a minute ago, never heard of. Steve Lynch, 19%, one of the Democrats. Ed Markey, only 12%. Republicans. Michael Sullivan, 35%, more than a third of voters. Dan Winslow, who was a chief counsel to a governor, was a judge, has been a state rep, and a pretty creative state rep, I should say, in the papers all the time. 57% never heard of him.
Remember how he used to run down.
Let me just finish. And 46% never heard of Gomez. I'm sorry.
Dan Winslow would run down to the governor's office and put, like, marshmallow fluff
outside
the office.
Yeah, he left one on my desk.
Too much fluff in the budget. He had all these little clever little schemes all the time. And he's worked really hard. That, I don't know. I kind of find that depressing, just in terms of the engagement of voters here. And we're pretty engaged.
Hey, Charlie, though, you know, is there I don't mean this as a joke. You may take it this way. Is there a senior statesman-like thing of Republicans in the state who get together, the Charlie Bakers, maybe the Browns, maybe Bill Weld, get together to talk about these things, about these issues, about whether or not you are fielding a decent number of candidates, or is it sort of a free-for-all? How does it work?
I think I would describe it more as a free-for-all. I mean, there's occasional conversations about this stuff, but for the most part, you know, politics, at least on the Republican side, I can't speak so much for the Democratic side in Massachusetts, is believe it or not, a reasonably organic activity. There are certainly party structures in place that help people, and there are local town committees and that sort of thing. But we don't have anywhere near the infrastructure on our side that the Democrats have on their side. And I think a big piece of the name ID stuff that you're talking about is partially a function of the fact that, you know, Ed Markey and Steve Lynch have both been in Congress and in the news for one reason or another for the better part of the past 10 years. I mean, they are huge veterans of Washington and therefore huge veterans of sort of the political process overall. And in the case of the three folks you're talking about, Mike had the highest name ID, but that shouldn't be surprising because he's a former state
rep,
a former district attorney down in Plymouth County, and a former U.S. attorney as well. So, I mean, to some extent, I'm not that surprised. I am a little surprised that Dan's numbers, primarily because of the amount of energy and imagination
so
and creativity he
brings
to the
drill.
He has
a lot of both. Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
And you wonder whether Gabriel Gomez is a very handsome guy, former Navy SEAL. Maybe that's a part of it, and he's got a lot of money to spend on this whole thing. But Charlie Baker, let's talk about the Democratic side. We've got Ed Markey, of course, United States Representative Ed Markey, leading right now, according to this new poll, Stephen Lynch, the congressman, by 11 percentage points. But then you look at the favorable and unfavorable, and Markey's unfavorables are much higher than Lynch's, almost double what Lynch's are. So what do you make of the prospects for Stephen Lynch?
I think if I'm Steve Lynch, I think this poll is basically good news.
Yeah.
This poll says there's a bunch of undecided voters out there, but my favorables are very good. My unfavorables are really low. And the other thing I would conclude from this, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, is what it basically says is the chord he's trying to strike in his ads appears to be working a bit. I mean, he spent some serious money already on TV, and the ads he's been running about the fact that he's just like you, more or less, is the way that I would describe those ads are. I think what one of the things this poll says is that those are effective.
And by the way, if people haven't seen the ads, the only ads on television so far are the two Democrats. Steve Lynch's are all biographical about him, and Markey's are all about issues, from BP to guns to
Lynch's,
that sort of thing.
He's got him strolling through the housing project in South Boston where he grew up. He talks about his father being an iron worker. He talks about becoming an iron worker himself.
His mom working for the post office.
Exactly.
Listen to us. We know the words.
Yeah. He's strapped on his work boots and all that, and the great story about his donating a half of his liver to his brother-in-law, too. He doesn't mention that in the ad, but that's a great part of the Steve Lynch story as well.
What's the old line in politics? You got to get them to like you before they'll believe you?
Yeah, well, he does have a great story to tell, I think. And, you know, he always made a joke when he thought he was going to be running against Scott Brown that Scott Brown had the barn coat, but it cost him $600 at Macy's or something, and Lynch's cost him $40 at Sears. So there you go.
Yeah, Scott Brown was U.S. Senator, and Steve Lynch isn't as of the moment. You know, one last thing on the Republican front, just to depress you a little bit more. You don't sound depressed, but maybe this will. Yesterday we read in the front page of the paper, Curry Healey, who 3 weeks ago people were saying, is she going to run for the U.S. Senate? Is she not? Obviously ran against Deval Patrick the first time, you run against Deval Patrick the second time, is leaving to become the president of Babson College. I mean, the bench is getting smaller and smaller, is it not, Charlie?
I guess that just means more opportunity for me, right, Jim? Why should I get depressed about that?
That's
very
right.
Fine point, actually.
All kidding aside, I think this is a really interesting and unique opportunity for her, and more power to her. And Babson, by the way, is a great place.
It is a great place.
Well, you know, Carrie Healey, I always thought, really smart woman, really talented woman, but very uncomfortable in the political role. I never thought she could relax into it, and it was very tough for her running for governor against a guy like Deval Patrick, who was like Mr. Personality, and that was, of course, the first time around before he ran against
Can you imagine what it's like to run against somebody like Deval Patrick, Charlie, or no?
I can't imagine. That
I didn't
really
think so.
Interesting.
Well,
yeah.
Think about it a lot. Gay marriage. We've talked about gay marriage before, but obviously it's Gay Marriage Day on Prop 8, oral argument this morning, gay marriage oral argument on the Defense of Marriage Act tomorrow. You know, the RNC platform, as you know, the Republican National Committee platform, comes out against gay marriage. But Reince Priebus, if I'm saying his name properly, the chair of the RNC, went out of his way the other day to say things like, quote, we have to strike a balance between principle and grace and respect. Do you get the sense that the National Republican Party is ready to strike that balance, or there's still the old wars?
I'm not that close to whoever's talking down there. What I can tell you is that I think the public's been moving on this issue for the better part of the past 10 years. And, I mean, I was obviously somebody who was an early supporter of gay marriage, and at the time, I think that was an unusual position to some extent. It certainly doesn't feel unusual anymore, and I think that's probably going to be reflected by anybody who's in politics, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. Think about how far just the Democrats have gone in terms of where Barack Obama was and Hillary Clinton was in the when they ran against each other versus where they both are now.
Well, you know, let's fast forward for 3 years. I may have told you this story last week. I asked Barney Frank in 2008 during the election, can a Democrat get elected president before gay marriage? And he said no. And then obviously 4 years later, Barack Obama showed how much things had changed. It's 2013?
13.
I may have asked you this last week, but I'm obsessing on this now.
Yeah, you did ask me last week, thereby proving you are obsessing.
I am obsessed. I don't see, how does anybody 3 years from now, with the numbers trending like they are, we mentioned this morning, 80-some percent of young people, 18 to 29-year-olds, 80-plus percent support gay marriage. How does anybody, Republican or Democrat, win in 2016 if they're not a gay marriage supporter?
As I said to you the last time you asked me this, I hate to predict what drives voters on election day because it's always so hard to know what campaigns will fundamentally be about. I mean, my view on the issue is pretty clear, and I would expect that you'll see others come over to my side of the table as well between now and then.
If I ask you again next week, will you have a better answer?
Probably not.
But you know, it is fascinating how fast things have changed in terms of gay rights. I mean, many people have pointed out this week, you know, women's rights, you know, hundreds, well, decades and decades and decades. Civil rights for African Americans, decades and decades. This has been like lightning speed. I remember Barney Frank. It was 1987 when Barney Frank came out as the first openly gay congressman. And your former boss, Bill Weld, I mean, he sort of stunned Massachusetts. Remember, Charlie, when he posed on the cover of The Advocate, the gay magazine? People were talking about it all over the country. There's Bill Weld. I think he was wearing some kind of houndstooth jacket or something like that, and he was boar hunting or something. But remember that? That was a big deal.
No, that was I think part of it was just that Bill Weld was clearly the only candidate in the country who used to be self-proclaimed, I'm pro-gay and pro-gun. And there just weren't a lot of those around. And he obviously had a particular way of generating some of his own news with whatever position he took.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of guns, you see the Mass Inc. study that was on the front page of the Globe yesterday about violent crime down dramatically over the last 30 years, incarceration rate up dramatically over the past 30 years?
I did.
And what do you do as a chief executive, if that's what you were? What would you do to rectify that situation, if anything? And obviously, in the piece, they also concluded that hundreds of millions of dollars was being lost because of minimum maximum sentences, failure to do post-release integration into society programs, that sort of thing. What would you do, Charlie Baker?
Well, I read the report, Jim, and I guess one of the things I would like to know a little more about, I mean, if you're on the other side of this issue, it would be pretty easy to say that one of the reasons why the violent crime rate is down is
so
many people are in jail.
Yeah.
But I thought the two most compelling parts of that report to me were number one, the whole issue around the fact that there's literally like no reentry program at all anymore. That and we all know about how screwed up our probation department's been for a very long time. I think Ron Corbett probably brought a lot of sanity to it when he replaced John O'Brien there. But there's no question that other states have done a far better job of thinking about reentry than Massachusetts has. And let's face it, if somebody serves a 15-year, 18-year, 12-year, 10-year term in prison and literally goes straight from being in prison to being out with kind of nothing in between, we shouldn't be surprised if our recidivism rates are pretty high. And
60%.
And according to that report, our recidivism rates are really high.
Out of 10 go back to jail within 6 years, according to that study,
which
me is pretty scary
as
a citizen.
How do you get a job? That's the problem.
Here's the other thing that bothered me about that report is it said in several different parts of the report, it said, and this is a classic Massachusetts government thing, and I speak as somebody who really likes and admires all those people who work in government. Massachusetts doesn't collect data on a lot of the component parts of what you would want to measure. And a lot of other states do when it comes to this sort of thing.
Like what?
Well, they had trouble collecting data around whether or not people were actually serving longer sentences now than they were serving before. They had trouble collecting data on if you were to tier people in terms of their likelihood to reoffend, they had trouble collecting data on that. Most of the data that And there's a whole bunch of parts in that study where they say other states collect data on the following, but unfortunately Massachusetts doesn't. One of the real struggles I think we have as a state when it comes to this and a lot of other issues is if you're not willing to collect the data and figure out what it tells you, you're probably not going to be very good at making sort of forward-looking decisions about what to do about it. But the one thing that was very clear in that report, I mean, if you look at the states that are pursuing a variety of reforms in this, okay, Georgia, Kentucky, yeah.
Arkansas,
South Carolina,
Texas.
Yeah. Arkansas, Texas. These are not deep blue states, right? These are red states that care a lot about quote the bang for the buck, so called. And I think that's something all by itself that would require us to take this pretty seriously.
Hey, Charlie Baker, one thing I'm dying to know that's not a political question. Well, maybe it is a political question. Tiger Woods, we're going to talk about Tiger Woods in just a couple of minutes here. He's back in the top in golf after, of course, his terrible situation with the 19,000 mistresses or whatever he had and his knee problems and stuff. But what was weird let me ask you. Were you glad to see him win on Monday? It was a rain day. I guess they just delayed the tournament for one day. I mean, you're glad to see him back on top. You're rooting for him or not?
I fall into the Jerry Callahan in the Herald this morning had a column
great
where he
piece.
Talked
great
about
piece.
All the people who cross their arms when they watch Tiger right. Woods play. That's kind of I've been married to the same person for 26 years. That's kind of where I tend to come down on this. But I will say this: I do tremendously admire the fact that a guy who clearly completely lost track of his game and his life and everything else seems to have figured out how to put it back together again. And we all admire stories of redemption, you know?
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
Are you, by the way, one of the, Marjorie and I were talking before the show today about the fact that there were stories written about one of the reasons that Jane Swift, your fellow Republican, was not a wildly successful governor. I think there was a story in the Globe or the Herald, is because she didn't play golf, and that's where a lot of deals are made. You play golf?
I have never played golf.
That's bad news, Charlie.
I'm not a golfer. But. I do like to drink beer. Okay,
there you go.
And I
shoot
do
some
like
hoops.
I do like to watch sports. And yeah. I think I can substitute drinking beer and watching sports for playing golf.
That's beautiful, Charlie.
Okay,
Baker.
Charlie Baker. Thank you very much.
Okay, guys, have a good one.
You too. We've been speaking obviously with Charlie Baker. He'll be back next Tuesday. He is every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow at 1 o'clock for Open Mic with Brian McGrory. And I think he can give us the inside scoop on Wegmans as well because he spent considerable time there.
Also, you know what you're going to get? I've mentioned this. I mentioned this yesterday. And we're going to talk to Brian about it more. And you should, if you have an opportunity for people who are listening before tomorrow, the Globe has written three parts of an ongoing series called Broken City. And the city they are talking about is Washington, D.C. And the most recent piece they have done, I mentioned this briefly yesterday, is about how a treaty, an international treaty on disability, the rights of people with disabilities, sponsored by former United States Senator Republican Bob Dolan, obviously a candidate for president in 1996, supported by all these Republicans, all these Democrats, was completely derailed by the testimony of one advocate, the head of some national homeschool association. It is the most devastating cautionary tale about what is wrong with Washington, putting aside the issue itself. And I think Brian's probably pretty proud of the series. We're going to talk to him a lot about it. And you'd probably be wise to read the story. It's long in advance. And hear what Brian McGrory has to say tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
You can also read his column at Wegmans. It won't take you nearly as long to read it. Okay. So Brian's here tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Up next, Tiger Woods, as we just discussed with Charlie Baker. He is back on Top of Golf. We'll look at how he made his comeback and ask you whether you were rooting for him this weekend. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
This piece of tape that you're about to hear is actually about social policy. Seriously.
Right. How's that net feel?
Thank God for this net.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Show me your safety net next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And New England Subaru, introducing the all-new Subaru XV Crosstrek with all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com. And Boston Private Bank, helping business owners, entrepreneurs, nonprofits, and families manage their banking and investment needs. This is your time. This is your private bank. Boston Private Bank. BostonPrivateBank.com.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. I don't play golf either, nor does Charlie Baker. You play golf a little bit, right?
I know how to play, but I'm not much good at it.
Your sister is a huge star
golfer. That's right. She's great.
In any case, you're listening to Boston Public Radio. And the reason we even brought that up with Charlie Baker a minute ago is because Tiger Woods is back. 2 weeks to go to the Masters. He's retaken the spot as the number one golfer in the world. He's back, and we want to know if you are back with Tiger Woods at 877-301-8970. He regained the number one position after he won the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Listen to this if you missed this. Here's Tiger on the 72nd hole. This is the last hole in the tournament, almost hitting an unbelievable 77-foot putt to finish off the tournament. Listen to the announcer.
So many incredible moments by Tiger on this 72nd hole in need of a birdie to win.
How about this one?
How about that one? That almost came
in. That would have been the best four of all time.
That's right, Roger.
Arnie meaning Arnold Palmer, after whom the tournament is named, liked it. And by the way, the ball landed, if you didn't see it, about 2 inches from the cup, and then Tiger chipped, just hit it in to win the tournament. Joining us on the line to talk about what this comeback for Woods from, I think, ranked 58th in the world a couple of years ago after his travails, let's say, is Shira Springer. She's the sports enterprise and investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. Hello again, Shira.
Hi, Shira.
Hello. Hello. I think travails is putting it kindly.
Well, that's right. He had the knee injuries, the divorce, you know, the wife with the golf club smashed in the back of the car.
And the many friends, let's put it that way.
And numerous mistresses there on the side, a lot of them with sort of shady past. But I feel embarrassed about this, Shira. I mean, I'm not a big sports fan, but I'm kind of rooting for him this weekend. Is this a bad thing?
I don't think it's a bad thing. I think in America we sort of make a sport of building up our athletes, tearing them down, and then building them up again. It's a pretty common cycle. I mean, Tiger Woods is not the only athlete who sort of had a scandalous fall and then been built up again. But you do.
Who's comparable to him? I can't really think of anybody. I suppose some of the guys that.
How about some of the drug guys, some of the steroid guys, and the human growth hormone guys?
I think you have to go to the steroid guys in baseball to come up with good examples. And
Michael Vick. How about Michael Vick in football with the dogs?
But he's never going to come back.
A perfect example. I don't think he'll be the same player he ever was because of age. And golf is a little bit different sport in that sense. But I hear you, Marjorie, in that it is difficult to root for him knowing his past. And it hasn't been that long a time gap. It's only been a couple years or a few years since he really hit rock bottom. And it's quite an amazing turnaround, but you definitely, I felt guilty.
Okay, so Shira Springer, our number is 877-301-8970. We want to know if you're rooting for Tiger. Will you watch Tiger? The Masters, one of the big four tournaments, is in 2 weeks. Why or why not? Okay, let's assume we wake up Shira Springer after the fourth round of the Masters, whether he wins or not, he's in competition, and we read what I'm sure we're going to read in the newspaper. A viewership was up, 42% over last year, solely a function of the fact that Tiger Woods is back. What do you write the next day in the Boston Globe, or what do you tell your friends? What conclusion do you reach?
Well, he is golf. He is once again golf. I mean, imagine if not only does he perform well, but Lindsey Vonn is there.
That's right. His new girlfriend.
The skier, yeah.
Exactly. Cheering him on. I mean, can you imagine the ratings if that's the case? I mean, I think you have to write the phenomenon that this is. And, but I think at the same time, you have to fill in the backstory. And I don't think it's ever a backstory that he'll be completely rid of. But, he will go on, I guess, to set many more golf records in terms of wins. And he, is good for golf, as odd as that may seem. Even when he was at his lowest, the will he, won't he come back, will he ever be the same Tiger again, kept viewers tuned in. When he didn't make the cut at tournaments, viewership fell off. So even at his lowest, he was still, generating both ratings and controversy.
So is it kind of like you're watching like Secretariat, the great racehorse or something, that you think that this is the greatest golfer who's ever lived, and so even though he really messed up,
Secretariat was not married to an individual
he
horse,
wasn't,
so Secretariat could
like,
do whatever he
it's
wanted.
It's like one of my favorite movies. I'm embarrassed to admit that too. I love the movie Secretariat. It's real sappy, but I really loved it because I love horse movies. But is it that? I mean, why are we so transfixed by this guy? That's what I'm trying to get at. Is it because he's the
I'll
best?
Answer He's probably the greatest athlete in that field who's ever played the game,
so that's
right,
the
Shira?
Reason, Shira.
I think it's the combination, though. I think in some ways he's the greatest there's ever been in that field, but
right.
I also think the scandal makes him a more compelling figure. Yeah. The scandalous past makes him, everybody likes the train wreck, and that's what it was times 100 with all the fallout and all the missteps. And there was a period of time where it just didn't look like. Mentally and also physically, I mean, he was racked with injuries the last couple of years, that he would ever get back to where he was. And there was also, I think, part of it that likes to see people realize their potential. And there was a sense, as viewers, as sports fans, that we were a bit cheated, what could have been. And now I think there is some rooting interest that we'll get to see what could have been. We'll get to see perhaps, Tiger reach his full potential. I mean, that's exciting in itself in some ways, to see greatness. You don't get to see greatness but yeah, once, maybe twice in a generation. And to think that he might have squandered that opportunity, but now we're getting a second chance to see it. That's part of what's compelling.
Yeah, that I guess that is it, that you think you're seeing greatness when you look at him. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. Our email is bpr@wgbh.org. We are rooting for Tiger this weekend. If you were rooting for him, did you feel guilty about it? Or is it okay?
I'll give you an example. I had no interest in watching the Masters golf tournament in 2 weeks.
Oh, no, forget it.
And I guarantee you I'm going to watch, despite my ambivalence about him, solely because of Tiger Woods.
But you know what I was also wondering about, Cher, because you know, obviously know a lot about sports, and I don't, but the endorsements are not where they were. He was making about $100 million a year, apparently, at his height. But I read this morning in USA Today that he was making about $50 million in endorsements, which is no small piece of change.
I think people were banking on the type of performance you saw this weekend, thinking, you know what, if he does come back, this is an awfully compelling story, and if we were there with him through thick and thin, you know, the interest will be there if he comes out of it. I mean, they were banking on a turnaround. They were banking on this great comeback. And you know, whoever is investing that $50 million, they look pretty smart right about now.
So, Cher, you're watching the Masters in 2 weeks, correct?
I'll probably watch the last day if Tiger's in contention.
Will you call us on the following Monday and tell us whether you had your arms folded in anger as he was sinking the winning putt?
I will.
Hey, Cher Springer from the Boston Globe, we really appreciate your time.
I'm getting a lot of ridiculing emails about Secretariat here. Well, I don't think I can read them on the
air.
They're not fit to be read.
Our number's 877-301-8970. Now it's your turn. Are you part of this return to Tiger? Are you still holding his sort of dastardly behavior against them? Or is it just, you know, before we get to the calls, do you remember, Marjorie, years and years ago, we interviewed Bill Russell in
yes.
the studio at our former radio station?
Oh, God, that was great. I was a nervous wreck.
And, you know, when you're in the presence of somebody who is the single greatest at what he or she did, it's almost indescribable. He's not a great basketball player. He was the greatest at his.
Why we were nervous.
Why were we so nervous?
We were nervous because every reporter who's ever interviewed Bill Russell tells you about how he bites your head off.
He was
and
fabulous.
I was a nervous wreck. He was so charming. And
he was
he
great.
Even did what apparently he almost never does. He signed his book for me.
For your son, that's right.
To give to my kids. So I was expecting to be screamed at for 10 minutes. And instead, it was like the charm offensive from Bill Russell. And I'm so excited they're finally doing the statue of him down by Government Center.
Let's go to Beth in the car. We're talking about Tiger Woods' return to number one and whether you're returning to Tiger. Beth, you're on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey there.
Hi, everyone. Nice to be on.
Hi.
I'm happy that he came back. I'm kind of rooting for him because my whole life I grew up with golf. I didn't golf, but my father and my brothers were huge golfers. And mm-hmm. I grew up with Arnold Palmer and other heroes. And that's what they were. They were heroes. And Tiger, since he went on the Johnny Carson show as a little kid.
Yes.
What happened, he was like an American hero, but almost like Superman. And when he fell from grace, in fact, it kind of made him a little bit more human. Granted, it was not a great thing that he did.
No, it was not.
But it also had nothing to do with him cheating in golf. You know, as far as golf was concerned, he was a purist, and I think he still is, whereas others who have fallen from grace because they've taken steroids or somehow like Lance Armstrong.
Right.
So that's a whole different thing. From my perspective, as far as pure golf is concerned, he's there, and I want him to do well.
So, Meg, one quick answer, Beth. Do you feel as though you're a sellout to your sex here because you're rooting for him? I sometimes feel as though, you know, I'm not doing what I should be as a female.
You know what?
What?
I'm a woman who broke the glass ceiling before a lot of other women did in a financial business, and yet I could still sort of see things from an objective perspective. I do not think that I'm betraying my sex in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, good.
I didn't think so.
Oh,
hey,
good.
Beth, that was a great call. Thank you so much for the call.
That assuaged some of my guilt.
No, but you know what? She said, not defending his behavior, his fall from grace made him more approachable. There was a more human, because it was, I mean, Tiger Woods was on this insane pedestal, so great at what he did for a living, and then all of a sudden he's horribly flawed like most of us are.
Lindsey Vonn is worried that he might fall off the wagon. I mean, how closely do you think you have to monitor the after golf doings of Tiger
Woods.
Think,
you know, there
or
may
is
be
he totally reformed?
There may be some people who are listening who don't even know who she is. Lindsey Vonn is an Olympic
skier. Yes.
She just had a serious injury. She's recovering. And then finally, this is what I love about celebrities. In postings, either on Facebook or their Twitter pages, they both announced last week two things. One, that yes, we're in a relationship.
Uh-huh.
But two, now that we've told you we're in a relationship, we'd like you to respect our privacy, which is sort of that great sort of oxymoronic way that celebrities often deal with it. So yeah, it's a new, it's an item. Let's go to Ron in Boston. We're talking about the rise from the ashes, I guess, of Tiger Woods. Hey, Ron.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I think that we're forgetting a couple of things. Number one, I think the reason why Tiger was put up on a pedestal so high is because as an African-American, or part African-American, we all understand that, that he was in a field that was not welcoming to African-Americans. So when he came out, when he was one of the greatest that ever played, arguably the greatest, that was what elevated his play to such a high level.
I think that's part of it.
He wasn't allowed to do it. So initially that, I think the second thing was, you know, he was a young guy. I think that his socialization, had he been a basketball superstar or anybody else in another sport, he probably would have carried on the same way, but he would have had a team of people around him to protect him. You know, they probably would have counseled him against marriage at such a young age, which, you know, obviously wasn't a good thing. He was, you know, he wasn't a responsible husband, and that's what happens when you've got all that money and power at a young age. I think that America also loves a comeback, and here he is once he got his emotional self back together after obviously a very trying time for him personally. Here he is at the top of his game, and America loves a comeback.
Well, you're also leaving one element out. I think it's a really good analysis, Ron. We talked the other day about the power of the sincere apology. I mean, Tiger Woods did that whole press conference thing with his mother sitting in the front row and did the ultimate, you know, I have sinned thing that I guess at least cracks some people's minds open. But Ron, that was a great take on this. Thanks so much for your call. 877-301-8970. You know what's one of these things?
What?
It's sort of, I don't
you
know
don't
if it's a great...
You don't think he's taking steroids, do you?
No. Well, how do I know? I have no idea.
He is really built.
Well, you know, that was the other thing.
He works out fanatically.
He was one of the first, when he started, no matter, I don't remember how many years ago it was, he was one of the first people that actually did working out. Because, you know, golfers, for the most part, at that point, not anymore, were sort of, you know, you figure they're having a couple of hot dogs, then they're going to the first tee, have a beer, go to the third tee.
They were not in really great shape. Remember Lee Trevino when I was a little kid?
Sure. Well, a lot of them.
He kind of lumbered up the 18th fairway. Yesterday, when Tiger Woods is lumbering up the 18th fairway, first of all, he doesn't lumber up the 18th fairway. This is a line from Jerry Callahan's column. He said, when Tiger walked up that fairway, the fans filled in behind him like teen girls screaming after the Biebs, as in Justin Bieber. And that's true. It's like maniacal. And I guess the other golfers that were with him may not have been that happy because, of course, everyone was following Tiger and not that many people were
following
him.
Have you seen the video of the putt that we played the sound from a couple of minutes ago?
I saw the news.
It is on. That's all I saw. It is on.
I know.
It's so perfectly. If it had gone in, obviously, it would have been even better. But 77 feet within a couple of inches,
yeah.
And then he ends the tournament. It's just unbelievable.
And I think he always wears the same thing. Doesn't he always wear a red shirt? Isn't that one of his big things, just to wear a red shirt all the time? I think he does have to wear a red shirt, or the last day he plays, where it's his good luck shirt. Maybe somebody knows that.
You know what we should also do? If one of you guys can look this up, there's a controversy. I just remembered Nike has a new ad out, which says something like, there's a picture of Tiger Woods immediately after he won the tournament, and the slogan is something like, and they're taking criticism for this, something like, winning fixes everything, or that sort of deal. If you can let us know, gentlemen and ladies, that'd be great.
You know, Jim, you always ridicule me for saying how much I love Secretariat.
Yeah.
I want you to know that although I've gotten some off-color emails about Secretariat,
yeah.
Mary Beth and Claire said, we loved Secretariat. It is a great family true story, and it is terrific. If you haven't seen it, it's fun to watch with your kids. I watch it like six times myself, all by myself.
The only thing that's almost as good as Secretariat, and almost as mm-hmm. it's almost as causes as much weepifying, mm-hmm. Mr. Ed. I always found when he says Wilbur, open the door, it is one of the most moving.
No, it's
sequences.
Not. It's the thing about Secretariat is in the Belmont Stakes, the last leg of the.
Here's
the line.
Here's the Nike spot. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Before I forget it, Chelsea just said it in my ear. Winning takes care of everything. Now, is that not offensive, by the way? That came out, that spot, immediately after he won the Arnold Palmer Invitational. The point being, now that he's number one again, nothing else matters. Winning takes care of everything. Classic Nike, is it not? Let's go to Mike in Southeastern Mass. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking Tiger Woods' return to number one.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Okay, pleasure.
First of all, let me just say that I'm completely neutral on the question of whether it's a good thing or not that Tiger Woods has staged a comeback. I'm completely neutral on the question of Tiger Woods' moral standing.
Yeah.
It's just I'm only calling because of a statement that was made by your guest very early in this segment.
What she said?
We in America have a tendency to build up and then tear down and then build up our athletes in cycles. And I would I'd like to dispute that point.
Go right
I don't
ahead.
Think it was me or anyone I know who
point.
Tore down Tiger Woods.
That's a good
Armstrong
point.
Or Roger Clemens. I think that these guys did it all by themselves, and that, you know, they attracted the tabloids' attention, and that's what happens.
Yeah, fine point,
that
Mike.
Is a good
Thanks
point.
For the call. That is a very good
Mike,
point.
Mike, thank you very much. We have some people. Paul just emailed and said he can't root for Tiger. It's like rooting for Microsoft, Apple, or General Motors. He roots for the underdog, not a smug, spoiled brat with a miserably unlikable persona.
Well, you know what's interesting about
God,
this? Putting
Paul,
aside his,
that bad.
His personal behavior and all the affairs and all this stuff, it is true. America generally does root for an underdog, but there's an occasional superstar in the Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods sort of terrain where people root for the prohibitive favorite. And I think there are a couple of exceptions to the rule. I always love the underdogs. I love, you know, like the New York Mets of 1969.
But it was the same thing with Michael Jordan, though. You thought you were looking at the guy who was the best basketball
exactly.
player
on Exactly. That's my point. Exactly. And you wanted
you were
him to
watching
win.
Him. And I think people were disappointed when you found out about the gambling stuff. Remember that? That was a little tough to take.
That was
Michael
a blip,
Jordan.
Sort of.
And you were sort of disappointed. Remember when his father was killed?
I do.
And
he didn't get
you
involved.
You wanted Michael Jordan to be, well, you wanted Michael Jordan to be an anti-gun spokesman. I, of course, did not.
Let's go to Herb in Brighton. You're on with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Tiger Woods. Hey, Herb.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Now, to get on the point that another caller said, sorry about that, sometimes we do in this country destroy athletes like we did with Muhammad Ali and the Vietnam War. But anyway, getting back to Tiger Woods, yes, I will definitely be rooting for him because Tiger Woods is associated with golf. He is Mr. Golf. You're cheering for the man because of his ability, not because of what he does off the, you know, off the greens, because all of us are fallible and we make mistakes and, you know, we fall hard. But, you know, Tiger Woods is, you know, a man just like anyone else. And, I mean, honestly, he's the type of person to where, yes, you're going to falter. Young age, money, power, respect, good looking, likable man. Yes.
But Herb, let me interrupt you and say, are you saying that if you're that good at what you do, whether it's golf or boxing or whatever, and obviously the Muhammad Ali thing, that was an act of principle on his part when he said, I ain't got no problem with them Viet Cong, and he refused to fight. Are you suggesting that we, because he's such a great golfer, we forgive whatever it is he's done on that wasn't on the golf course?
Well, honestly, there really isn't anything to forgive. I'm not a part of Tiger Woods' marriage. I don't know the man.
Well, wait a second. How about you mentioned boxing? How about Mike Tyson was convicted of rape?
Well, that's
that's a totally different.
He isn't related to Desiree Washington or whatever his name. Why is it different?
That's a crime against.
Yeah, Herb.
Okay.
Here's where I think
that's totally different.
Here's where I think we can all criticize Tiger Woods, morals and no morals. This guy's loaded with dough, $100 million a year in endorsements. These poor mistresses. He never bought them more than a cheeseburger. Remember that? You know, he'd fly them out. He'd fly them out. Wouldn't even give him first class. He had to fly in the back of the airplane. That poor waitress he went out with. I don't even think he took her to dinner. Now, come on, Herb. If you were carrying on like that, wouldn't you at least give someone a nice filet mignon?
Well, I would personally, but at the same time, these women, they did get with him knowing full well that he was there.
Hey,
and
Herb.
They wanted the experience. That's all.
They wanted the experience.
The experience. Herb, beautifully put. Thank you so much
Big
for the call. Squeeze one more quick one
was.
In. Jack, you're our last call on this thing, Tiger Woods, from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hey, Jack.
Hey, good afternoon, and thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
Yeah, you brought up an interesting point that the whole... you know, following a leader or following those that are elitist, such as Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods, that's something that I always found myself doing, despite the fact that I've always for the underdog. But, you know, the fact is you do have to make a segregation between Tiger Woods, the athlete, and Tiger Woods, the husband and father, to a certain degree. I think an elitist athlete, such as Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan, you know, if indiscretions occurred, they occurred off the court or off the green. Although I imagine maybe some of Tiger's occurred on the green, but that's the story.
In the sand trap, I understand, Jack. But, it was outrageous.
But my point is that you have to make a segregation between the two. And what he did to his wife and his kids, that's shameful. But that's the personal man. You know, ironically, that put a chink in his armor from my perspective, and I was a big fan because of his professionality on the course and
right.
his killer attitude. His no take no slaves attitude or prisoner attitude toward winning a tournament. But ironically, as a bit of a traditionalist and a lover of the game of golf, what bothers me most about Tiger Woods now is his periodic attitude on the course, the cursing.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I hate it. I agree with you.
You know, ironically, that's, you know, right now, that's something that prevents me from getting entirely on the bandwagon. But, you know, I did find myself years ago, although he's, you know, if he's a stroke ahead, I still want to see the guy. I still want to see the guy win. Although I am, like you, one that always goes for the underdog.
Hey, Jack, thanks for a call. A fine call. We appreciate it. Jack from Portsmouth,
I don't think
New Hampshire.
Jack Nicklaus, the Golden Bear, ever swore and threw clubs, did he? Maybe he did.
I don't remember.
You should
well
know
enough.
That, Jim.
Okay,
check it out for you. I guess I don't have to feel so guilty as I did now for rooting for Tiger Woods. I've been relieved of that. Up next, it's Pledge Time on Public Radio. Film critic Garen Daly joins us for a primer on how to ask for money using Hollywood films as a guide. This is really clever, and it's next on Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio keeps you connected to all corners of the globe. So it's only fitting that right now, your contribution in any amount means you're automatically entered to win a trip for two to Hong Kong, including airfare, four-star hotel, island tours, culinary adventures, and more. Thanks to the Hong Kong Tourism Board and General Tours World Travelers of Keene, New Hampshire. Enter to win when you give online at WGBHnews.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, offering complete health care for you and your family. With 21 locations across Greater Boston, Harvard Vanguard welcomes new patients and accepts most insurance. HarvardVanguard.org, an affiliate of Atrius Health. And the Huntington Theater Company, presenting Ryan Landry's M, the heart-stirring new adaptation of the film noir classic, Not for the Faint of Heart, March 29th through April 27th. HuntingtonTheater.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're in pledge season here at Public Broadcasting. Actually, it's the first one for Marjorie and me since we've been at GBH.
No.
You know,
exciting.
That we both spent 13 years in commercial radio. So to help us, I guess you'd say, with the transition from commercial radio to public and to get us into the pledge mentality, we are joined by film critic Garen Daly. Hey, Garen.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. You can really pull this off for us?
No. I just come in here because I wanted to be with you guys. You know?
Well, we're happy to see you, too.
Okay. No. So what's the scoop? What's the deal? What are we going to do here?
The scoop is, you know, as Jim was just saying, you know, it's March Madness time.
Yep.
It's spring training time, and it's pledge season. And then I started looking around, and I saw, you know, there are approximately one film festival for every week in New England. There are 50 film festivals.
Is that really true?
Wow.
That is really true. And that's a conservative estimate. I mean, there's a bicycle film festival. There is a Bulldog Short Film Festival, which I think is down in Yale.
Bulldog Short?
There's a Short Skirt Film Festival. But the one that I liked the best was in Bellows Falls, Vermont, No Film Film Festival.
So what do they play?
I don't think they play anything. I think they just
That's
show up
clever.
There and have a Zen moment. So I think we had to create a WGBH fundraising film festival where the titles tell it just like it is.
And you broke this
like
down.
This.
You broke down the whole fundraising notion on public radio. And I know you have some films you're going to name and play. And by the way, if you guys out there at 877-301-8970 have any films, either the title or the content itself, which you think sort of could be the background for public fundraising on public radio, you broke it down into five categories.
Don't forget the email.
I'm sorry. And BPR at WGBH.org. What are the five categories
Categories. I mean, this is what I do. I love to deconstruct things.
Please. Mm-hmm.
So we broke it down as that there's always the need.
Of course.
There's always the need. Yep.
Acute.
Then there's the reality. Then there's the reason why people have to give. Mm. Then there's the inspiration, and then actually how it is done.
And you have films under each of these categories. Give us a sense. Start with any film you choose. I know that you have Sound Of, which you think will get us in pledge fundraising mood.
Let's think about the need. Okay. All right. Clear and present danger.
That's very
good.
All right. Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now.
Or Apocalypse Not Quite Yet, I think we could probably say. But
yeah,
could be.
Yeah. Or Panic Room. The Black Hole. The Road Warrior. Now, the reason the Road Warrior. Someone came up with this because if we don't raise the money, then it's going to be the post-apocalyptic world where Mad Max is going around and creating all sorts of accidents and cars.
I like this. I like this, actually.
And there's also frenzy, too, because you've got to remember that there's this need to build up the frenziness of what's going on.
Is that Alfred Hitchcock movie that I saw
years
ago?
Yes. It's a minor Hitchcock film.
It's a minor Hitchcock film. It's pretty good, though. The serial killer runs around strangling everybody in Great Britain.
Right, with a necktie.
Yeah.
That conjures up feelings of fundraising on public radio, doesn't it? A serial killer.
Makes you really want to give, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a good movie, though. I saw it late night on TV.
What sound do you have? What films do you have sound from that will get us in the pledging, the fundraising mood?
I think that what we need to do is we have to go back to one of the masters.
What's that?
And that is Woody Allen. And Woody Allen's second film.
This is pre his Misbehaving. Go ahead.
Way beyond that. Yeah. Back when he was really funny.
Okay.
And Take the Money and Run.
One of the funniest movies of all time.
And to set this clip up, this is the scene where he's going into the bank to try and rob the bank.
Mm-hmm. Here it is.
Show me the money!
Whoops. Well, that's irrelevant, too.
That was a show me the money.
Here it is.
$1,000 into this bag and app natural. What's app?
Act. Does this look like gub or gun?
Gun. See? But what's app mean?
Act. A-C-T. Act natural. Please put $50,000 into this bag. Act natural. It's not... Oh, I see. This is a holdup.
And the great thing, if you didn't see it before and you couldn't make that out, he does a note saying, "Give me the, I have a gun." And the teller says, no, it says gub right here. It says G-U-B. It doesn't say G-U-N. Is that, by the way, the film where he's playing the bass fiddle in the marching band?
That is correct.
And he has a chair in a marching band. He plays one or two notes. Then he picks up the chair and then has to run to catch up with the marching band.
Right, and his name is Virgil Starkwell.
Oh, of course.
Movie.
That's right. Okay. So
he
that
has
we
to chase the band.
Take the Money and Run. Again, the early Woody Allen. I think one of the funniest movies of all time. So you did The Need. How about The Reality? What are some titles that speak to that, Ghirardelli?
Well, I was thinking like Other People's Money.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Because that's really what we're all about. The Money Pit.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I think people look at it as you might be The Grifters.
One of the greatest movies.
Another great movie.
The Wife of Warren Beatty. What's her name?
Annette Bening.
Angelica Houston.
John Cusack.
Fabulous movie.
Great movie. Friends with Money. Gold Rush. Beg, Borrow, and Steal. The Killing, and of course the great Von Sternberg film, Greed.
Yeah. What's The Killing?
The Killing is a gangster movie that was done in the 50s, a noirish film with Sterling Hayden. It's very, very good.
Okay.
Something to put on your queue.
You weren't born then, Marjorie.
You're a film critic. How do you watch your movies? I mean, besides
with my eyes open, usually.
Besides going to the theater, though, do you do like the Netflix thing? Do you do the Comcast On Demand? What do you do?
Well,
at-home viewing.
Oh, at-home viewing. Well, traditionally, most of the films are what is known as trade screened, which means that you get to see them before they come out. And unfortunately, I get to see a lot of them before they come out. So at home.
You get DVDs.
So, yeah, no, and screenings. You go to you usually go to the Dedham Showcase at 10 o'clock in the morning and watch them, or you go to a critic screening in the afternoons. So I don't do a lot of Netflixing. In fact, that's a whole other topic of why Netflix is starting to do their own created content.
What's the name of that series where they broke it? We talked about this last week, where the whole
Kevin
series
Spacey.
Is available when they're releasing it.
That's binge viewing, but I can't remember the name of it either.
Yeah, binge viewing. What's it called again? House of Cards. Thank you very much, Chelsea. Appreciate it.
So you don't watch movies at home?
I do watch movies at home.
How?
I have a Blu-ray player, a DVD player. Okay. I've also got cable, and I also pull it off the internet at times.
Now, have you pulled any other sound from movies that will get us? I'm beginning to get into the pledge season mood. Do you have anything else?
Well, I think that we could go talk about go to the topic number three, which is The Reason. And Armageddon is a great film. Actually, it's not a great film. It has a great clip in it, but
we're going to hear that.
We're going to hear that right now.
Okay, let's hear it.
I address you tonight. Not as the President of the United States, but as a citizen of humanity. We are faced with the very gravest of challenges. All of you praying with us need to know that everything that can be done to prevent this disaster is being called into service.
I'd write a check. I'm going to write a check.
Well, good. Make it out to me, please.
I'm missing. What is that? I assume Armageddon, you get the sense. Is that the end of the world?
There's a big asteroid going to hit, and Bruce Willis goes up.
Oh, it's a Bruce Willis movie.
It's a Bruce Willis, yeah. But, you know, that film reminds me of a great 1979 film called Americathon, where America has gone bankrupt, and it's 1998, and America's gone bankrupt, and so they have to do a telethon to get the country out of hock. And what I love about that movie more than anything else, it was so prescient.
Yeah.
For instance, here are some of the themes that were in Americathon. First of all, China becomes a capitalist dream state. Nike becomes an international juggernaut. The USSR collapses. Reality TV dominates the airwaves. The U.S. dollar has been devalued, and U.S. is dependent on oil, and the wealthiest people in America are Native Americans. That's all in this
movie. What year was this movie?
1979.
That's pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if they had, imagine it, if they predicted this happening in 2008 instead of 1998, which is when the collapse did become, people would be absolutely hysterical.
It would be. It would be.
So that's under the that's part of the inspiration? Is that what your category is there?
No, that was part of the reason. Let's get, and again, some of the other ones in the reasoning category. How to Beat the High Cost of Living.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Give Up the Ship. It's a mad, mad, mad world.
Do you remember that movie?
That.
Oh, yeah.
That was about 100 stars were in there.
100
stars.
All the stars. And one of Spencer Tracy's last movies. I love Spencer Tracy.
So did I.
Give the Devil His Due, which is also The Devil and Daniel Webster.
I don't know if they'd pick that one here, but go ahead.
For a few dollars more.
And so in the next category you have is the inspiration.
Right.
What falls into that?
I think these are actually films that, you know, they're a call to arms. And they do have a certain amount of, you know, reality based. And, you know, things like Calendar Girls, which is based on a reality. Music of My Heart. Which
Calendar
is,
Girls are the women in Great Britain who strip down or go topless to raise money for the... That's one of the great stories. Didn't you write about them at some point?
I did. I wrote about them at some point. But I'm just going to tell you this, interject this. I was in Rome last week visiting one of my kids, and I was over there.
Oh, you weren't there for the...
I wasn't. Well, I turned out to be there at the time, the Pope. But they have this calendar priests thing that they're selling in bookstores all over the place by the Vatican.
You said priests?
Of priests. It's pin-up priests month by month by month.
But
of course,
not like beefcake photos.
No, they're in their cassocks. But,
okay,
they're real priests. And I thought it was just so funny. Pin-up priest. Can you imagine that, Garandaley?
Right next
to the Vatican.
No. But, you know, going back to the inspiration, I think the ultimate inspirational giving film has got to be It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, I mean, really.
And we have a clip of that film right now.
I weep every time I hear it. Here it is.
Quiet. Now get this. It's from London.
Oh.
Mr. Gower cabled you need cash. Stop. My office instructed to advance you up to $25,000. Stop.
Oh.
Hee-haw and Merry Christmas, Sam Wainwright.
Never gets old. We only have a minute left, Garandaley. Your last category is how it's done, which is obviously pretty important. Give us a couple from there.
Last Seduction, Pretty Persuasion, Color of Money, Blackmail, Sweet Charity, For a Good Time Call.
How late were you up figuring these out? That's what I want to know.
Actually, this is actually pretty quick. I mean,
it is?
I mean, I think this is one of those things where you just, all the war titles just kind of flow.
So, Garandaley, film critic, the most important question is, after doing all this preparatory work and getting us into the pledge fundraising mode, did you write a check?
To you?
No, not to me. To WGBH for all of its good work.
Not yet.
You will today, though. Is that correct?
Of course. Absolutely.
You want to come back?
Yes, that's
exactly.
Why.
Thank you. Hey, Garandaley, film critic, we really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Garen.
We want to thank everybody for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, a bunch of things. Obviously, we're going to follow up the oral argument on DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is tomorrow. It's also Ask the State Secretary of Transportation. Rich Davey will be in the studio to sell the governor's transportation planning hopes and to answer all your questions. Then at 1 o'clock on Open Mic, editor of The Globe, Brian McGorry. We'll talk to him about The Globe's series called Broken City, about utter dysfunction in D.C., and we may call some memories of his time at Wegmans. He wrote a fabulous column. That's it for today, though. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan, and thanks for listening.
We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye, guys.